We're about to take our own ocean voyage of a sort. You know, because of the nature of this job, I get to spoil myself by reading a lot of books. I love reading anyway, and to do it every waking moment if I could get away with it. As it is, you know, I get to devour dozens of books per year. I can't think of anything I have read in the last 5 years that affected me as profoundly as what we're about to discuss. You know, I saw a review of this book months ago. I knew we had to check it out. And it exceeded all my expectations. The subject is riveting. The writing is superb. The research is meticulous. And this story, this tragedy, really touches a nerve in ways that I think we will explore over the next few hours. And for anyone who's not a student of naval history, you know, the first time most of us probably heard what little we know about the USS Indianapolis, it can be traced to one of the best scenes in the history of American movies. It's from the blockbuster Spielberg movie Jaws. Robert Shaw's character, Quint, delivered a moving, powerful, slightly tipsy account of what motivated him to become a shark hunter. Here is an edited version of that scene to serve just as a reminder to you.
1,100 men went into the water. Vessel went down in 12 minutes. Didn't see the first shark for about half an hour. Tiger, 13-footer. You know that when you're in the water, Chief? You tell by looking from the dorsal to the tail. What we didn't know was our bomb mission had been so secret, no distress signal had been sent. So 1,100 men went in the water. 316 men come out, the sharks took the rest, June the 29th, 1945. Anyway, we delivered the bomb.
You know, the true story of the U.S. Indianapolis is every bit as dramatic, as tragic, as terrifying as what the character Quint described in that movie. The new book, Indianapolis, takes us into the minds of the sailors and into the water with them as well, as one by one they die of exposure or madness or are devoured by sharks. And then what happens to the survivors is an equally riveting story. Lynn Vincent and Sarah Vladeck spent years working on this. It's an amazing piece of work. And in a moment, the authors join us to share this gut-wrenching story. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Indianapolis, the true story of the worst sea disaster in U.S. naval history. The two authors are Sarah Vladeck, an acclaimed documentary filmmaker, one of the world's leading experts on the USS Indianapolis. She became obsessed with the story at the age of 13, and over the next two decades, she met and interviewed 107 of the ship's survivors. She produced an award-winning documentary film about the disaster, and has done a lot of other research, still researching this story. Lynn Vincent is the number one New York Times bestselling writer of 11 nonfiction books with more than 16 million copies in print. She's a veteran journalist and author of more than 1,000 articles, has done investigative pieces that have been cited before Congress and the U.S. Supreme Court. Sarah and Lynn, welcome to the program. I am blown away by your book. Great to have you here.
Great to be here. Thanks, George.
Sarah, I'd like to start with you. How did you get hooked on the story at age 13? Most teenagers at 13 are not reading about the USS Indianapolis.
Well, it actually was a documentary that I saw. I was watching it with my dad. It was about the Pacific War, and they reduced the story of the ship to a single line, which was, it was the ship that carried the bomb and sunk. And I had to know more about it. And so, you know, at the time, there was no Google or anything like that. So I actually had to go to the library. Imagine that. And, you know, through looking through what was available at the library, I still really couldn't find anything. So I thought, well, someone's got to tell this story. You know, from what I did learn about it, it was very interesting. And I think there was just a lot of mystery surrounding it. And so, you know, I sought out what I could, but thought, you know, oh, someone will tell this story before I'm old enough to do it. And, you know, flash forward, I graduated from college and said, well, no one's told the story in, you know, the right way yet. So I sought out the survivors and found Paul Murphy, who was the chairman of the survivors organization at the time, and he invited me to a reunion. And that's where I actually got to meet them, the men who survived Indianapolis. And, I mean, you know, I was a kid who was meeting her heroes for the first time, and they exceeded all expectations, and they took me in, kind of became like family. So, you know, they, a couple of years later, after I had spent time with them and visited them at their homes, they asked me to be their storyteller. And that's kind of the Cliff Notes version of it.
And Lynn, for you, how did you hook up with Sarah on working on this project? You've done so many other books. I would imagine that being able to write the true story and correct wide and great misperceptions and strike a blow for justice for the for some of the key characters would be an amazing draw for you.
Well, it was a very exciting project for me. The way I got involved was I had actually been praying. I do pray about my work, and I had been praying to have an opportunity to work on an iconic World War II story. And all of a sudden in 2011, out of the blue, I get this email from this young filmmaker named Sarah Vladek. Well, what Sarah didn't say about her journey with Indianapolis was that in being Indianapolis a storyteller, she wanted to render the story as a screenplay. And she actually did that. She wrote an eight-part miniseries, and she pitched it to a major production company, and they said, hey, this is the best thing we've seen since Band of Brothers. But we only base miniseries on books, so you're going to need to write a book. She was like, well, shoot, I'm a screenwriter. I don't know how to write books. So through family and friends, she reached out and made contact with me. And she didn't know, number one, that I'm a Navy veteran. She didn't know that I had been praying for an opportunity to do a story just like this one. And my only problem was is that all she was wanting was advice, and I wanted to help her write the book. So my joke is that I had to figure out how to manipulate her into letting me help her, but eventually over the course of several months, we finally met, and then we agreed to work on it together, and we didn't really get started in earnest until 2014, and then when we did, the project took us 3.5 years.
So, Sarah, were you on a campaign to right a wrong, that the story had been wrong, that a lot of people who were key players had been treated unfairly? Is that how you started, or you didn't know about that when you started?
I didn't, you know, I knew a small part of that. That was definitely part of what I wanted to tell, but really, I mean, the major objective of it was to tell the whole story of this ship. You know, she had been reduced to a sinking story or a shark story, and no one knew she was this incredible ship that Admiral Spruance commanded, you know, most of the Pacific War and the campaigns that he participated in from her deck, or that Roosevelt took her on the first cruise, you know, a U.S. acting president ever left the country on. So there was so much more, and I was like, well, you know, everyone's got to know what an incredible ship this was and what she did besides being sunk.
I'll tell you, it grabbed me. My father was at Okinawa and Iwo Jima. He drove a landing craft from the ships, took troops onto the shore. So, of course, you know, the fact that the Indianapolis was involved in those conflicts got my attention. I'm imagining him being there in some of the scenes that you describe. Lynn, why don't we start with you describing sort of the capsulized version of what the world knows about the USS Indianapolis. And then we'll go to Sarah to give us the version that you guys have helped uncover.
Okay, that would be great. Indianapolis, as Sarah mentioned, was the Fifth Fleet flagship. And a small part that a lot of people don't know is that she was the flagship at the Battle of Okinawa, where your father drove the landing craft. And in the weeks leading up to the actual invasion, she was participating in the shore bombardment, and during that time, on March 31st, 1945, she was hit by a kamikaze. 9 men were killed, 26 injured, and that was what really sent her on this fateful journey. Had that not happened, she might have gone down in history as the victorious flagship of the World War II Pacific Theater, victorious at Okinawa, as well as 9 other major battles. But instead, she went back to Mare Island, California for repairs, and that's where she was on July 16th, 1945, when General Leslie Groves and the other leaders of the Manhattan Project, including President Truman, decided that they wanted to send the components of the atomic bomb Little Boy, which would later strike Hiroshima, ahead to the forward areas. And Truman did this, a lot of people don't know that Truman did this before he even knew that he would use the bomb, because at that time, everyone thought that there would be an invasion of mainland Japan. So Indianapolis was selected to transport these fissionable components of the bomb. She did that, made a record-breaking run to Pearl Harbor, and then pushed on to Tinian Island, where she dropped off the components of the atomic bomb. And then 2 days after that, on July 28, 1945, she set out on what was going to be a routine voyage across the Philippine Sea from Guam to the Philippines, an almost straight westbound shot. And right when she was in the middle of the middle of the Philippine Sea, on July 30th, 1945, just a few minutes after midnight, she intersected course with a Japanese submarine called I-58, commanded by Lieutenant Commander Mochizuru Hashimoto. Hashimoto fired six torpedoes, hit Indianapolis with two of them. The first one almost completely blew the bow off the ship. Indianapolis was a heavy cruiser. The second one hit her amidship. The vessel went down in 12 minutes. And, you know, we've been talking longer than 12 minutes. It was very, very quick. About 300 men went down with the ship. A little under 900 made it into the water alive. And when they made it into the water, those who survived their wounds were very optimistic that they were going to be rescued soon. But they weren't, and they spent 5 nights and 4 days in the water struggling to survive. And as you mentioned earlier, they fought madness, they fought dehydration, they fought sharks. Eventually, they fought each other because of the madness. And that is the story that most people know about Indianapolis. She was spotted completely by accident about midday on the fourth day after 5 nights and 4 days in the water, and only 316 men survived.
Sarah, secrecy plays such an important part in this at every step of the way, and it leads to tragedy, tragic results because of the secrecy of what they were carrying, and it sort of continued over after they had dropped it off. Why don't you share with us how secrecy, which obviously was necessary, military necessity, led to tragedy, and how it probably interfered with your ability to get at the core of the story.
Absolutely. I mean, there were, you know, multiple areas that held secrecy in this story that led to the demise of Indianapolis and ultimately the men being, you know, lost at sea for 5 days. You know, first of which being how messages were transmitted across the Pacific during the war. You know, there was a level of coding that had to be taken into consideration, and you know, one of the ships that Indianapolis was to report to when it arrived in the Philippines was Admiral McCormick's, and the message he received was garbled. And so, you know, protocol said that, oh, it didn't, you know, didn't come through clearly, and no one asked for a repeat. So they didn't even know Indianapolis was supposed to be reporting to them. You know, that was one of the first things. So when she didn't show up, they didn't know she was supposed to show up, you know. Aside from that, there was protocol that non-combatant ship arrivals didn't have to be reported. And so when she didn't arrive, a young lieutenant thought, well, I guess I don't have to report that either. And so he, you know, took it upon himself not to say anything, even though he knew the ship wasn't there. And these were all put in place, you know, to protect our vessels during wartime. But the secrecy of that and the protocols ultimately led to her not being found, you know, and then beyond that, you know, we had broken the Japanese code at this time, and there were message trafficking going across the Pacific and the Philippine Sea, reporting, you know, various subs in the area. Well, none of that was relayed to Captain McVeigh because they didn't want anyone to know that the codes had been broken and that we were using that. And so, you know, he should not have been there without an escort. He should have, you know, had, you know, taking a step back, Indianapolis was not, you know, made really for combat. It was made to get to a scene or to a battle quickly and have guns. And so she should have had something, you know, first of all, that had sonar, and second of all, that had any kind
armor.
Of ability.
Yeah, armor, too.
Yeah, and armor. I mean, she was part of the treaty cruiser, so her armor was exceptionally thin compared to many of the newer ships. And so that was one of the reasons why she sank so quickly, you know. So all of these things kind of came together to form the perfect storm. And so much of that played into the secrecy of this mission and why she was out there and why this information wasn't passed along to the captain, who may have made different decisions knowing that there was a direct threat in his path.
Tell me this. Was it difficult to get the survivors to trust you? I know there's been so many wrong stories and wrong conclusions made about what happened there that I would think they might still be suspicious even decades later.
Well, I think a big part of it, as I mentioned, is that I had spent several years visiting with them, spending time with their families, talking with them, that, you know, with no other interest other than learning their story. And so they, I think, trusted me by the time that I actually wanted to start doing interviews and putting the story down on film or, you know, as a screenplay and eventually as a book. And Lynn as well, when she came in, we had this trust built in with these men that they knew I genuinely wanted to tell the accurate story. However hard and however long that would take, we would tell the true story.
Well, it was amazing how widely you cast a net here, you know, in creating real characters. You get to know these people. A lot of the people who are characters of the book obviously didn't survive, so you're piecing them together, I guess, from people who did know them. But, you know, maybe among the most interesting is Hashimoto, the guy who was commander of the sub that sank the USS Indianapolis. Lynn, talk about him a little bit. He's not our stereotypical Japanese commander.
That's right. One of the things that we tried to do is really pull back the lens on the Indianapolis story, because really the man, before I get to Hashimoto, just to you know, circle back to him, the man who carried the atomic bomb aboard USS Indianapolis was an Army major named Robert Furman. And he had spent the last couple of years of the war running down all of the fissionable material that they feared the Germans were using to try to develop their own atomic bomb on the continent of Europe. So once that mission was complete, and then Furman carries the fissionable components of Little Boy to Tinian Island, that is the final braiding together of the European and the Pacific conflicts. And so in writing the whole book, we tried to pull back that lens and bring in a lot of these other characters and world leaders and figures, including the Japanese point of view. So in addition to Hashimoto, we had Emperor Hirohito and Motomi Ugaki, who was the kamikaze commander. And what we tried to do, George, was to recognize that even though those men were enemies at the time, that they were all acting out of sincere conscience and conviction and doing what they...
I'll tell you what, I'm sorry to interrupt. We have to take a break. We'll come back and you can talk a little bit more about Hashimoto and some of the other central characters, including Captain McVeigh, who took the brunt of the blame. We'll be right back talking about the Indianapolis tragedy here on Coast to Coast AM. We're talking with Lynn Vincent and Sarah Vladek about their book, Indianapolis, the true story of the worst sea disaster in U.S. naval history. You know a little bit about it. We all do. But the true full story is pretty amazing. Daunting heroism and tragedy and terror all mixed into it. And in a moment, we're going to get into specifics about what happened after those torpedoes slammed into that ship. We'll be right back. So, Lynn Vincent, I interrupted you before the break. You're about to tell me about the Japanese commander a little bit.
Yes, Commander Hashimoto, Lieutenant Commander Hashimoto. As I was saying, we tried to present the Japanese point of view in a sympathetic way. meaning that they were acting out of their sincere conscience and conviction. And so we were able to make great use of Commander Hashimoto's, well, it was a memoir of sorts that he published after the war. He first published it in 1952 in the Japanese language, and then it was later published by Henry Holt in the 50s here in America in English. And it was really an examination of Japanese submarine warfare in World War II, but written from Commander Hashimoto's point of view. And there was a chapter on it devoted to Indianapolis. But because we were looking at the larger Pacific War and the end of the of World War II in general, we were able to really develop his personality a lot. He was a commander who cared for his men. He was a commander who was very, very frustrated with the state of technology on Japanese submarines and really against protocol at the time, because Japanese had a very autocratic top-down military. He went around banging on doors asking for radar and more technology for his submarines, because Japanese submarines didn't have radar right up until the end of the war. And so he was very frustrated because he was seeing a lot of his brother sub-commanders go down to salty graves for lack of technology. So he's very caring. He had a wife. He had three sons. And eventually, in addition to his book, which was called Sunk, we were also able to interview his granddaughter and get even more information about his later life after the war.
Well, as we'll find out a little bit later, he was kind of ticked off because the U.S. Navy, I mean, it took the extraordinary step of having him testify at a court-martial for Captain McVeigh, and then they didn't really want to hear his version of how things went. But we'll circle back around that. Sarah, I want to get to the moments right after these torpedoes slam into the side of the Indianapolis. Chaos breaks out. You know, we heard that clip from Robert Shaw in the movie Jaws saying that no signal was sent, no distress signal. Not exactly true, but sort of true. Why don't you pick up the story there? Tell us, describe those next couple of chaotic moments after the torpedoes hit.
Sure. Well, it was just after midnight, so, you know, the moon was behind clouds. It had been an intermittent cloudy night, and so, and that was part of the reason why, you know, I don't know if we would say it's lucky for Hashimoto, but the clouds just parted and the moon came out for just a moment, enough for him to see the silhouette of the ship. And so, you know, after it was struck, and the power went out with the second torpedo, and so there was no power on the ship. They couldn't communicate over the first MC, you know, the PA, the sound system. And so there was no one to say abandon ship, you know, over the speakers. There was no one to tell people to report to battle stations. They had to pass that from mouth to mouth. Well, this is a 610-foot-long ship. It's a great big ship. So with the chaos happening and the ship sinking in 12 minutes, you have to imagine that compartments are flooding incredibly quickly. You know, the ship is starting to tilt first to the starboard, and then it goes down by the bow. So men are being trapped inside the ship, unable to escape from their compartments. And, you know, Lynn had mentioned before, they believe about 300 men went down with the ship. And even further to this, because there wasn't any direct command able to be broadcast to the men, people started abandoning ship very shortly after the ship was torpedoed, all the way until, you know, men went down with her and were able to escape. So these men were spread out for over a mile and a half, is what they believe. And, you know, those who went down on or went off on the starboard side, the low side, they would have been with more of the supplies. You know, there were only 12 rafts that they believe got off the ship. But, you know, standard protocol at that time was to go off the high side, the port side. Well, the majority of the men went off that side, and there was no supplies. So they weren't in rafts. They were, you know, some weren't even in life jackets. Some were holding on to flotsam that they could find in the water as long as they could until they could get to someone who could help them, you know, a fellow shipmate or whomever. And others had to just swim until a sailor would pass away, and then their buddy would help them take the life jacket off the dead sailor and put it on them. I mean, this was incredibly chaotic. So scary. These are 16, 17, and 18-year-olds that had just got on the ship not some of them not even 3 weeks or a month earlier. You know, they just went on board right before the last mission, hadn't really gone through any drills yet. Some didn't know how to swim, and they're just thrown into the middle of the Pacific at midnight. It's pitch black. They're covered in fuel oil because, in an effort to save the ship at the last moment, Lieutenant Redbane actually released the fuel into the water. And so this is very, very thick oil that can only be transferred with heat. So it's like tar on these men, and they can't tell who anybody is. They can barely breathe. They're swallowing it. They're vomiting. They're, at this point, they're trying to stay alive. Some have injuries, and they won't last much longer. They say that those who had injuries didn't really make it past the first day. But the men who were able to escape without injuries were still suffering from the early stages of dehydration because of vomiting this fuel oil. So no one's in really great shape, you know, by the time the sun comes up the first morning. But they're very optimistic that rescue is going to come because they believe there's a ship in the Philippines waiting for their arrival.
And there wasn't. There were attempts to get a signal out that just didn't go. I guess they weren't successful.
Exactly.
And I guess within a couple of days, it becomes clear that no one's coming, or if they're coming, they're going to have a hard time finding it because, as you describe in the book, they're spread out all over the place, and these big waves are pushing the groups further and further apart, right? Lynn, maybe you want to talk about that a little bit in this context. There's incredible acts of heroism that you describe from some of these sailors who are doing their best to help everybody else. And then at the same time, there's some incredibly selfish acts of brutality that happen as well.
Well, that's right. There were incredible acts of heroism. And as you mentioned, and as Sarah mentioned, the currents, they move at about 1 mile an hour in that area, and they also move in these sort of giant eddies or whirls, if you will. And so two men that would be together in the morning could be a mile apart by afternoon, and all the time these 12-foot swells, some days it's clear as glass, as on the day of the rescue, but some days there these 12-foot swells along with these currents. So over time, over the course of the 5 nights and 4 days, the men become spread out over a 25-mile area. And one of the rescue pilots later wrote that from altitude, a rescue plane looking down on a situation like that, the head of one man would be the size of a human hair seen in cross-section or diameter from across the room. So basically, they were invisible. And you mentioned acts of heroism, acts of cowardice. One real hero was Captain Park. He was the commander of the Marine detachment that was aboard the ship. And the largest swimmer group in the water, see, as Sarah mentioned, The men in the water were spread out initially over a mile and a half, and then they just got further and further apart with those currents. The largest group that had nothing but life jackets was about 400 men, and Captain Park was in that group, and he really spent 24 hours a day trying to keep the men together. The only resource that group of men had besides their life jackets, which not even all of them had life jackets, was a single line that was about 100 feet long. And so they formed that line into a circle, and the men were to tie themselves to the line. And Captain Park would help the men that didn't have life jackets. And several times he would get a life jacket from a dead sailor and then give it to another man who needed a life jacket. And he did this numerous times. And he would round up the stragglers and encourage everybody, until finally on the third day he succumbed to hallucinations and he died. And when he died, that group became very desperate because they thought, wow, if this brave man can't make it, how are we all going to make it? And then in terms of cowardice, you had precisely the opposite happening with some men being selfish, some men, even officers taking a place on a raft, for example, when there were wounded men who needed the place worse. There was also the in some of the RAF groups, they had some supplies, and there was hoarding of supplies and of water especially.
Yeah, so I was thinking as I'm hearing these stories, even without the injuries and the terrible burns and the fact they have no water supplies, they're out there and exposed to the elements for days. They have no water, and after days, they're just going crazy. And then, you know, you have to deal with the sharks. That's the terror that most of us know about because of the movie. And apparently that is not exaggerated, not by much anyway. Sarah, maybe you want to talk about that part of the story.
Yeah, not at all. I mean, you know, the shark population in the Pacific at the time was much more concentrated. And from the reports from the survivors, you know, there were hundreds of sharks circling them at any given time. And, you know, there would be frenzied attacks. And I think, you know, Lynn and I both heard, you know, tens of stories of just men and, you know, having their buddy right next to them taken. You know, and they didn't know who the sharks were going to attack. There was not a real rhyme or reason to it. And so they were always in fear. And one of the most harrowing stories was where, you know, there were about 15 men on a floater net. And those were the kind of nets that had the cork pieces throughout the net to keep it afloat. And the men were spread out on this. And just this huge frenzy of sharks attacked. And there was nothing left. And so reports like this were coming in that, you know, and even all the way until rescue. I mean, part of the rescuers' accounts, because by the time that the rescue arrived, the men were really incoherent. They weren't able to tell or know what was happening by that point in the story. But, you know, the rescuers are reporting that they're fighting off sharks. They're literally punching sharks in the face to be able to pull men aboard because the shark attacks increased. As I guess, you know, I don't know how much sharks realize things, but they said it seemed as they were pulling the men from the water, the sharks, the attacks increased. And, you know, this is, I can't imagine how horrifying that would be. I think seeing one shark would give me a heart attack, and imagine hundreds of them. You know, one of the sailors reported they were so thick they could walk on their backs, you know, from shark to shark that were underneath them just swimming there. They could actually stand on them.
There's one account you have of a sailor who he's sort of becoming delirious, and he's looking down, seeing sharks, thinking, ah, there's food. I'll just reach down and grab some food, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. A young ensign by the name of John Wolfson, he actually took his socks off and thinking he was going to wiggle his toes as bait to lure the sharks in and catch one. And then, you know, he kind of came to his senses at the last minute and realized, oh, this is probably not a good idea. But, you know, he was nearly out of his head at this point and put his sock back on quickly and managed to stay safe, you know. So they were
some
doing
of the worst
of
so, some of the worst effects, Lynn, happened to those people who drank seawater. They just went completely crazy.
Yeah, that was really chilling to me because, you know, here, you know, if you can imagine, they're on their ship, everyone knows it's almost the end of the war. They're having this leisurely sail, they think, across the Philippine Sea. And then, you know, the next thing they know, they're trying to survive this horrible ordeal, these young sailors who were just playing pranks on each other the day before. And then by the second day, 48 hours in, now we were talking about the hoarding of water, but as Sarah mentioned, there were only 16 rafts. Between there were four groups. Was it three groups? Or there were four groups of four rafts, or three groups of four rafts. In any case,
there were four groups of four rafts, but then the one group split apart on the second day.
Okay, that's right. So any water that was available was only available on the rafts, and so there were only about 40 men among all these hundreds and hundreds of men who had any water at all, and so by, you know, the second day in and the third day in, they were starting to get very desperate from dehydration. And so there were some men who absolutely knew not to drink the salt water no matter how thirsty they got. But there were others who, although they knew that, the sun and the exposure and the dehydration itself was perversely causing them to lose their faculties, lose their ability to reason. So some of them succumbed to the idea that they could strain the salt out of the water. And so you'd see one sailor holding up a torn piece of his shirt while the other one poured the water through it into his mouth and thinking that that would strain the salt out. Well, of course it didn't. And then others would, you know, take small furtive sips of seawater, hoping that no one would see them and talk them out of it. But then eventually they would just begin gulping it like they were gulping it out of a mountain stream. And what happens with this is a condition called hypernatremia, and blood vessels burst, blood cells tear loose from the brain, brain short circuit, just like when a tree branch falls on a high voltage line, and they would just go out of their heads, and they died very horrible deaths from drinking seawater.
You know, you have the Japanese commander who decides, let's get out of here, because he figures there's no way this ship is here by itself. Something else has to be around. Either that or it was out of sight all of a sudden, and he thinks, oh, it must have gone away, or he couldn't imagine, I guess, immediately that it had sunk that quickly. So he leaves, which is, I guess, fortunate, because they could have surfaced and finished them off. You have somewhere as a pilot who ends up testifying at the court-martial later, an American pilot who saw what he thought was a battle. He ended up telling somebody about it, but no one paid attention. We got to go to a break in about a minute. Maybe, Sarah, you want to talk about that guy?
Yeah, there was a gentleman by the name of Richard LaFrancis, and he was an Army pilot. He was transporting a general who had been wounded, and, you know, the general's up in the cockpit with him, and it's a late-night patrol, you know, it's just after midnight. And they see this, you know, kind of explosions coming from below, and there's no reports coming in saying that there's any kind of enemy action. So he thinks, well, maybe this is drills or something of that nature. But, you know, I guess it seemed kind of out of sorts for him. So he said, well, you know, I'll report it. And he did actually try to report it a couple times. And, you know, the Army side of things said, well, let the Navy do whatever they're doing. Just ignore it. And he still went to, you know, he asked Navy personnel at Guam, I believe, you know, hey, I saw this. Should anyone look into it? And they said, no, there's nothing reported in that area. Don't worry about it. And so, you know, there's actually more to the story with that where, you know, his son who, you know, this gentleman, Richard LaFrancis, he passed away, but his son carries on his story. And, you know, he actually had diary entries of the time and the coordinates of when he saw this, and it did line up with it, but he didn't find out until a few days after when word was released about it that he would.
We're talking with Lynn Vincent and Sarah Vladek about Indianapolis, the true story of the worst sea disaster in U.S. naval history. In a moment, we'll talk about sort of the aftermath. It's amazing that anyone survived, but there were survivors, and what came next is equally amazing. We'll be right back.